qualifications for elders, and we are on to the next part of it tonight. Last Wednesday night, we talked about the first qualification, which is that he must desire the office. And tonight we are moving on to talk about the fact that a bishop must be blameless and the husband of one wife. Now, let's do a little quiz on last time. Have you got your thinking caps on? Everybody ready for the quiz? Don't say it out loud right away because you want to give your neighbor a chance to see if he or she knows it. And hopefully you will get more right than your spouse or your friend sitting next to you. Okay, here we go. Oh, before I do that, let me tell you the chart that's been coming around is a chart from BibleCharts.org. And I just found this website today. I was getting ready to make you a chart showing the different qualifications from 1 Timothy 3 and then Titus 1. And then I thought to myself, Caleb, why are you doing this? Somebody else has probably already done this. And so I just did a quick search and I came across this site, which is run by a congregation in Red Boiling Springs, Tennessee. Some of you may know where that is outside of Nashville, Red Boiling Springs, Tennessee. And their preacher, who has passed away now, made this site with a ton of Bible charts. And I don't know him personally, and I don't know this congregation, so I don't want to say that I recommend absolutely everything on there without any equivocation. However, everything I saw on there was really good, and including these three charts. So if you would like to go and find some good Bible charts for yourself, then you can. Let me just briefly tell you what these charts say. You can see on the first one, it's got your qualifications from 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. On the second page, you have a categorization of those or a division of those into the negative ones and the positive ones. The negative ones say he can't be like this, and the positive ones say he must be like this. So you see that broken up there in both of those passages. And then the third sheet I've given you has nothing to do with elders in particular. I just thought it was such a cool chart that I thought as long as I was giving you some charts, I may as well give you this one too, because it shows you how relatively short the New Testament books are. And it just struck me when I looked at it, if you take a Bible that contains almost 1,300 pages, which from what I gather is a pretty average size Bible, then you look at how many pages are consumed by each of those books. Here you have, for example, 1 Corinthians takes up 14 pages. And I was just struck by the fact that when God has given us the plan for his church, he didn't make an encyclopedia's worth of information on it. Now, if you or I were starting to write down guidelines for how the church should be organized, or if we were writing down a biography of Jesus, or if we were giving a book about revealing things concerning the end of time or concerning the destruction of Jerusalem, we might give thousands and thousands of pages because we would feel that, well, that's just what people do when they write books of such important topics. You make them real long and thick. And when people write religious creed books, for example, they're very often extremely long and detailed and hard to read, and really you've got to just be so scholarly about that to even master certain aspects of it. But when you read the New Testament, it's relatively short. So many church problems could be solved if people could just master 14 pages of 1 Corinthians. Think about how much better the church would be if people would just read and understand those 14 pages. There's not a lot there, but we have exactly what we need. Or you can look at it for yourself. But for example, one of the great treatises on love, on Christian love, is 4 pages, 1 John. And yet, if we would really study that and apply it, our lives would be so much better. Okay, and then you see the Old Testament itself, the whole thing's less than 1,000 pages. And that tells the history of the nation of Israel from creation, even before the nation of Israel, from creation to the time just before Jesus came is less than 1,000 pages. So that was impressive to me. Okay, quiz time. Are you ready to go? Here we are. Question one. The two chapters in which we read the qualifications for the office of elder are 1 Timothy blank and Titus blank. Okay, think. It's 1 Timothy 3 and Titus. Well, I only heard a couple of voices. Titus 1. Okay, good. Now, quiz number two. Match the Greek words with their English equivalents. Okay, I have not got them lined up in the right order there, so you're going to have to help me. Are you ready? Okay, presbyteros means Presbyteros means, somebody say it out loud, we did it last time, elder. That refers to the older age or the maturity of the person. Okay? Episkopos means, okay, say it out loud where I can hear. Episkopos means bishop. Very good. And that refers to overseeing. That refers specifically to his authority over other people. Okay? Now, that leaves only one. Poimen means pastor. And so that refers to his care and feeding of the flock. So looking out for the souls of people. Now, all three of those refer to looking out for the souls of people in some way, but pastor really zeroes in on that. All three of them will be similar in meaning in some aspects, but those are the main emphases there for those words. Okay, number three, true or false, the office of elder was only for the miraculous age. And the answer is false. It's for today too. Next one, a man is qualified to be an elder even if he does not desire the office. What is the answer? False. Very good. Okay, next. A bishop must possess every qualification to sinless perfection. What is the answer? False. That's right. Okay, now last one. True or false? The study of the eldership is of interest only to those who are elders or who may one day qualify for the eldership. What is the answer? False. That's right, because it's of interest to all of us. And I guess I made all the true false ones false. That was not very good. Does that mean I'm not a very positive person? I hope not. We'll try to make some of them true next time. But now here's the chart we gave on that to indicate that a study of the eldership is of interest to everyone. We gave several reasons. You may be able to think of some more, but here we all are to serve under qualified elders, so we should understand how they become qualified. We're all in the position of being under an eldership, so it's very helpful to us to know how it is that somebody got to be an elder. Why is it that that person is an elder and not somebody else? Well, it has to do with the qualifications. Very good. We all must learn how to relate to the elders. And incidentally, one of the things that this class should do for you, if it's conducted properly, is to give you a great respect and love for and admiration for good elders, such as the ones we have here. I mean, once you really understand what elders do and how they get to be qualified, which is no accident, and once you understand the assignments with which God and Jesus, the Good Shepherd, the Great Shepherd, has given them, then you start to think it's serious business to be an elder. And churches who have good elders, like we do, should be very thankful for having that. Some of us have been around congregations that struggled with either unqualified elders who have been appointed when they shouldn't have been, or congregations that had no elders. Let me just tell you a quick story about that before we move on. When I was about to figure out where to move after I was getting done with school, I hadn't been to Macklin Road yet, but I went up to this congregation to try out in West Virginia, and it was a very beautiful part of the world. This was, well, I don't want to tell you where it was because it's not going to reflect too well. But I went to a congregation in West Virginia, and they had no elders. And they had a meeting with me to ask me questions and to talk about what might work out between us as far as what they would expect in the work and so forth, lots of details. And it was a men's business meeting because you have to gather with the men to lead in circumstances like that, and you don't have elders. So they kind of sat around. It was time for the meeting. We were all there, and it just never would get started. I mean, it was like nobody wanted to take the lead and start it because nobody wanted to step on the toes of the other person. And that was a sign. I finally just kind of said something to the effect of, well, do y'all want to ask me some things or what would you like to do? Because it just, they were joking, and they were not ugly, but they were just kind of chewing the fat is what we say where I'm from. They were just kind of hanging out. And I didn't have much. I had to fly back to South Carolina the next day. I didn't have a whole lot of time to get to know them. But they were not intentionally dragging their feet, but it was just hard for them to be structured because none of them was appointed as an elder, and so nobody wanted to really take the charge. Now, that's just one example of the kinds of hard things. It's just hard to get anything done if there's not somebody to take the lead and make decisions. Okay, so that's just one example, but it's very important that we appreciate the elders. Now, next, we must all encourage future elders. Every mature Christian ought to be in the business of looking out at young men who may potentially one day be elders. may even be looking at older men who may be ready to be elders soon, but trying to encourage them to go ahead and take that step. Think about really doing it. We all are trying to encourage the future leaders of the church, so we need to know how to encourage them. For example, what if you were trying to encourage a young boy to become an electrician one day? And if you were trying to really say, set your sights on that, wouldn't you want to know something about what's involved in being an electrician? Wouldn't you want to say, now here's some things you could study if one day you want to be an electrician, because I think you'd be great at that. You try to give him a little, maybe give him some electronic stuff to play with as a kid. You know, you try to get his interest spurred in that direction. And Daniel can tell us more about this than I can. He's an expert in that area. But now thinking about the eldership, what are we doing for younger boys to try to say, here's what you might want to aspire to one day, to be an elder. What would that involve? Now, if we don't know what it involves, then we can't really inspire them to do it. Parents, especially, I'm thinking about fathers. Fathers get this about sports because fathers say, I'll show you how to hit the baseball. Or the father says, I'll show you how to throw the curveball. Or the father says, I can show you how to shoot the basketball. But then sometimes when it comes to spiritual things, if we're going to say, how do I train my son so that he'll be ready to be an elder one day, do we even know how he would get to be qualified for that? That's urgent. We need to know how to spur him on in that direction. Okay, now, we all must guard against the restructuring of the biblical pattern for the eldership, and we'll really hit on that tonight with the idea of being the husband of one wife in just a minute. Here are the three words. We mentioned that before, so I'm not going to revisit that. Here's our verse for tonight. This is all we're going to cover is it's the first part of 1 Peter 3:2. Just the first part of 1 Peter 3:2. And it says, an overseer or a bishop, that's the other word for bishop. This is just one translation, English Standard Version. An overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife. King James Version says it this way. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. A bishop therefore must be without reproach, the ASV says, the husband of one wife. And I think all those are accurate translations of this. That's the basic idea. Any questions about this before we move on and start to talk about what these words mean in some more detail? Okay, we're thinking about blameless. What would it mean for somebody to be blameless? The first thing we need to observe is that it doesn't mean that they have never done anything blameworthy or that they never do anything whatsoever that is blameworthy. Because anytime somebody sins, that's blameworthy. It may be that only God knows about it, but that is worthy of blame. And so we're not saying that somebody is sinlessly perfect. For example, Peter was an elder in 1 Peter 5 and verse 1. He says, I am also an elder. But was Peter sinlessly perfect in his life? I think each of us could find that even as an apostle, Peter made mistakes. He denied the Lord. He looked away from the Lord and started sinking in Matthew 14. In Galatians chapter 2, we read about him making a mistake in the Jew and Gentile controversy, and he didn't have any backbone about that, for at least for one instance, and Paul had to stand up to him. And Peter, he says, in fact, in Galatians 2, it says, I had to withstand Peter to the face because he was to be what? Blamed. Okay, and Peter's an elder. Okay, he may not have been at that moment, but at some point, Peter was an elder, and he was also the kind of a person who was capable of doing something blameworthy at some point. So we're not talking about sinless perfection. Now, of course, Miss Doty had a very good question last week when she said, if it's not the case that an elder has to have all of these qualifications to sinless perfection, to that degree, then how do we know when he's got it to a high enough degree? How do we know that when he's got one of these qualifications to a high enough degree? And our basic response to that is, and you all may want to make further comment on this, our basic response is that God has given us a certain number of qualifications that we have to use our good judgment in applying. And furthermore, I believe that when we have somebody in a congregation who meets all these qualifications, we will know it. I think when you look around in a congregation and you start to ask, who meets all these? Then it becomes pretty clear who you're looking at. Whether you're applying 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1, you're looking for, I believe, the same person in each case. And in our quarter, we're focusing only on 1 Timothy 3 for the sake of time. We're not going to look at everything in Titus 1, although we may make some comparisons there, but we're looking at 1 Timothy 3. I think when we look at somebody who, for example, is not quick-tempered, we can pretty much be a judge of whether he is that way. And then we look at the total person and we see that he's not totally lacking in any of these areas. He may not be perfect in all these areas, and it may even be that he's a little bit stronger personally in some of the areas than he is in others, but that he meets all of the qualifications. I'm not saying it's an exact science, but we are saying I think we'll know him when we see him. Comments or questions about that? Anything from the elders? Does that make sense to y'all? Yes, ma'am. Right.
Because then Christ died in vain, because Christ died for us for our sins. If we have no sins, he didn't die for us.
Well, that's right. Hebrews 2:9 says that he tasted death for who? For every man. So that means every man is in the predicament of needing him to die, needing Christ to die for him. So everybody's in that category. What if a congregation took the position, we know that this man has made a mistake in the past, so we're never going to let him be an elder. Would that be right? No. Now, it could be that he has sinned so grievously in the past that his reputation is never going to be such that we would feel comfortable with him serving. I suppose that's possible. That could happen in the case of someone. But for us to just say, if we know of a sin that somebody committed, and therefore he can't be an elder, well, he's, I suppose, repented of that sin. For the sake of argument, let's just say he repented of that sin. If it was publicly known, he came forward and he expressed his repentance. We prayed for him. We said he was forgiven. So are we going to let him be an elder or not? Again, not saying that that just holds, that somebody can live as a reprobate and then go forward and say, I repent of my sins and then be an elder next Sunday. We're certainly not saying that. But what we are saying is we're talking about human beings, and the eldership is for human beings. Everybody clear on that? I want to add anything before we go on. Here are some verses that you all know that emphasize all human beings sin. So if it were the case that the eldership were for perfect people, then ain't nobody going to be an elder. But of course we can have elders. Okay, anything about that? So blameless, what does this word really mean? It means, here are some different commentators, people who are more expert in Greek language than I am, who are telling you what this word exactly means. For example, Vines, in his expository dictionary, he says, that cannot be laid hold of. What would that mean? That would mean that nobody could seize him and say, seize him physically, but just, metaphorically, seize him and say, I've got a hold of something bad in his life, and here's an obvious reason why he shouldn't be an elder. Here is something that you ought to be holding against him. You know, that this is a problem in his life. Can we think of some times where men's names at some point have been put up for an elder in a congregation somewhere, and then somebody says, maybe goes to the elders, the existing elders, privately and says, you need to know something about him. And I love the church, and I can't let him become an elder without telling you this thing if you don't already know it. And very often that happens in places, I'm sure. Or thinking about how the outside community will feel if somebody's appointed an elder. What if somebody outside in the world finds out so-and-so's been appointed an elder, but he lives this way? And maybe people in the church don't know it so much because they just see him on Sunday. But then it turns out, what's he doing during the week? And if people out in the world are going to be struck by, okay, down at the Church of Christ, they made him an elder? That kind of thing would be covered by this idea of blameless. It also would be covered by the thing in the other qualification in chapter 3, verse 7, that says he's of good report to those who are outsiders. So he's got to have a good reputation in the community. And that would fall under blameless too, I think. How about Thayer says not apprehended? And Linsky says of such character that no one can rightfully take hold of the person with a charge of unfitness. So this is kind of a general qualification, that there's got to be nothing that somebody could justly bring up and say, whoa, hold on a minute. Here's a Bible passage that he's not following, and he makes a practice of not following this passage. Okay, questions or comments about that? Here's some more. Kittle says that blameless refers to one who cannot be attacked even by non-Christians because of his moral conduct. This word means the same that it means when it's used in 1 Timothy 5:7, talking about the widows in the congregation and how the widows are to be treated in the benevolent work of the church. And it says, command these things well so that they may be without reproach. That's the same word, without reproach, that's used here in 1 Timothy 3 for blameless. Okay? Now the word, I thought this was interesting, the word blameless is the negative form of a word from which we get our word epilepsy, or the epileptic referring to seizures. And so this idea of seizing him, a seizure, you know, seizes up somebody, and that's why the commentator before was saying the word means you cannot seize him. You cannot grab him on any charge. Kind of the idea of arresting. You shouldn't be able to arrest him in a spiritual sense and say, this is a big problem for him. Okay. Now the word blameless in Titus 1:6 is actually a different word. It's a different Greek word. So it's the same qualification, I believe, but it has a little bit of a different shade of meaning. Same qualification, blameless. But in Titus 1:6, the word actually means no charge can be brought against him. And it implies, Vine says, not merely acquittal, but the absence of even a charge or accusation against a person. So maybe it really just means innocent. When you think about this person, do you think about him as being an innocent person? Okay, now let's step back from those definitions and say for a minute, how could we train young people to lead lives such that when they get to be 45, when they get to be 50, this would apply to them, that they would grow up and they would be blameless when they get to be. This is a hard world in which to grow up and be blameless by the time you get to be 45 or 50. What kinds of things would you say we need to be telling young people so that they get to be blameless when they're ready to be an elder? Yes, sir. Okay, good. That's right. And that's right. Good point. So he said two things. The first is the way to get young people to grow up and be blameless is to show them an example. This is one way, to show them an example of blamelessness, to make sure that when our sons and daughters think of us, that there's no major sin of which they could seize us, for which they could seize us, that when they think of us, they know we make mistakes, but their overall view of us ought to be, there is no passage in the New Testament that applies to my father that he is actively disobeying. He's not perfect, but I can bring up any passage of Scripture in the New Testament that applies to him, and he's trying his best to obey it. And so if they have that example, they'll be much more likely to grow up and be faithful themselves. And the other thing he said is that sometimes our children may not grow up to be elders. Some of our children are daughters, and so obviously they're not going to be elders. But if they grow up and have all these qualifications that the elders have, with the exception of the husband of one wife and ruling well his own house, if they grow up and have those qualifications, then they're going to be great, faithful Christians. And they might be great elders' wives. There you go. Think we're on the same. We have ESPN, you know. We are on the same wavelength in saying that they may be great elders' wives, they may be great deacons' wives, they may be preachers' wives, and I'm so thankful for the good preachers' wives and elders' wives. We're going to talk about the elders' wives here in a little bit because they factor in to the qualifications, and an elder's wife could disqualify him. A potential elder's wife could disqualify him. So, very good. What else would you add? What do we need to be doing for our young men, especially to make sure that when they get old enough, they will be blameless? Be very careful of the friends they make. That's right. Evil companions corrupt good morals, 1 Corinthians 15:33. And we have a lot to do with which, if we're parents, we have a lot to do with which companions they have. I've always thought it was very important for young people that their closest friends, they may have acquaintances from all around the neighborhood and all around their school and everything, but I think it's very important that their closest friends are those people who are going to be a good Christian influence on them, and that take it seriously. Yes?
Also,
the significance of... That's right. So they learn that there are consequences. That's right. If you learn that there are consequences in little matters when you're a child, then you'll very easily understand the principle that you got to take care to do things right, because there are bigger consequences the bigger your responsibilities get. And that's why Jesus told the parable about the talents, where he said that you've been faithful over a few things, and I will make, or you've been faithful over a few things, I'll make you ruler over many things, is because you understand how to deal with situations that have consequences. That's very good. What else? Yes, sir. Right. The Jeff's comment there was about the social media and saying that that's such a big aspect of children's lives today. And if you don't believe that, then talk to some kids, because you're going to see that they are using Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat, and there's some that I'm probably forgetting. But they are using those to communicate. And some children, during their teenage years, have so soiled their reputation by what they've put on social media, that people, that's public information mostly, or largely public information that other people can see, that it may take them years to recover their influence. And influences can be recovered over time in certain cases, but that's very problematic. It really is. And especially with the gossip that goes on. That's one of the craziest things about Facebook, is that you can gossip back and forth so quickly, and that's been going on, I guess, ever since the internet came around. But very, very dangerous. Very good. We need to watch that. What else? Influences. Let me give you another quote. David Lipscomb, this might get your mind to running on this a little bit more. He talks about the word blameless and says, blameless men are those whose character is unimpeachable, who stand in high public estimation, known for their pure life and their spotless integrity. That's a high calling. I think he's accurate about the meaning of the word blameless, but that is a really high calling. So what if a teenager is living now in a rough and reckless way, in kind of an anti-authoritarian way, where he just kind of does whatever he wants to do and doesn't like to be told, doesn't like to be given instruction about anything? It's going to be very hard for him to reverse that trend and become an elder material at some point. So it's why it's very important for parents to start early in training their children to respect their authority. And that involves the discipline of the children, and especially spanking of the children, and helping them to learn how to study the Bible appropriately. All these things. Here, you're teaching kids to listen to their authority, to the parents, and then they'll listen to God's authority one day. Good. Now, why is blameless important? I think it's probably obvious, but here are some very specific reasons why it's important for elders to be blameless. First of all, an elder's got to be an example to the flock. So here's this example issue that we mentioned a moment ago. If the flock looks to the elder and says, he's not a good example, well then, that doesn't inspire them to greater faithfulness, does it? They need to be able to look to the elders as these shining examples of righteousness and faithfulness to inspire them. Elders must lead the congregation in recovering those who have become unfaithful. But what if an elder goes and knocks on the door of somebody who's become unfaithful, as our good elders do, and then the person is able to look to the elders when he comes to the door, and he's not a faithful member, he comes to the door and says, why are you coming to ask me to be more faithful? You're not faithful to the Lord. Let me tell you what, you know, I'm better than you are. You know, if that's the situation, he's going to have a real hard time. The elder's going to have a real hard time getting the people to understand the situation they're in, because he is of a low quality. He's got to be blameless. There can't be anything that an unfaithful member could take hold of and hold it against the elder when the elder comes to the door to say, why don't you be more faithful? Okay? What are you going to ask?
I was just saying anything scriptural.
Anything scriptural, right? Yeah, right. Okay, elders must warn the congregation against sinful practices and teachings. But if an elder is involved in sinful practices, or if he doesn't know the difference between a true teaching and a false teaching, then how's he going to be protecting the flock against that? So it's very important that he be blameless. Questions or comments about that? Okay, y'all are kind of quiet tonight. I don't know. Jump in there. Okay. Now, ready to go to the husband of one wife? Husband of one wife? Ready to move on to that? You can bring up stuff about blameless later if you want to. Okay, he's got to be the husband of one wife. This means only men, and this is the Greek word for the male. There's another Greek word for humanity in general. Sometimes we talk about mankind, and we're using a generic word that can refer to men or women, right? And in Greek, it's the same way. There's a word anthropos that refers to just mankind. That's the word from which we get anthropology, like human anthropology. But in this case, we're using the specifically male word. So it's referring to the male of the species. He's got to be a man. Now, that is a problem for some people today, isn't it? There are many people in religion today who say, how could you possibly exclude women from the eldership? And, of course, nobody would deny that women stand on equal footing before God for purposes of judgment and for purposes of how special they are in creation and for how worthy they are and for many, many reasons. Women are on equal footing before God. But God has given different roles to men and women. I don't have to tell you that. This is nothing new. But it's very hard for some people to understand in our current contemporary context that God could have a different role. And that he could have created men for certain roles and women for certain roles that are different. And that refers to situations at home, of course, but it also applies in the governing of the church. And if you have a problem with Paul's language here, then you'll have to take it up with him, because that's just what he says. He says they've got to be aner, they've got to be men. Husband of one wife, literally a man of one wife. He's got to have one wife. So men have got to be married. And to just one woman. This would have been especially pertinent in that day because of widespread polygamy. Paul was, I think the main thrust of this was not only that they've got to be men, but they can't be polygamists. That's not such a problem in our context, although it is in certain quarters. There are certain people who push for polygamy. But our issue is more about the women issue. The feminist movement has caused a lot of problems about this verse. But that's clear, I suppose. Now, why the husband of one wife? Why is that important? Now, I've put several reasons here, and you may be able to think of them some more, but it's not because marriage is a holier state than celibacy. It's not that somebody is closer to God if he's married. There are certain blessings that God affords to married people that he doesn't afford to other people, but one can be a faithful Christian and be right with God whether he's single or married. It's not holier to be married. Incidentally, it's not holier to be single, as some people in religion teach. There are certain people who say that you can be a better Christian in the eyes of God or somehow closer to God if you're single. That's not the case either. An elder must have children, 1 Timothy 3:4, so the only proper way for him to meet that qualification is for him to be married, so that makes sense. How about an elder's got to be given to hospitality? 1 Timothy 3:2. It's going to be a lot easier for him to meet that qualification if he's got a wife who's helping him with hospitality. Those of you who came to the open house over at my place and saw how dreadful I am on the process of I'm kidding about that. I mean, hospitality is more about opening up your home rather than having everything exactly lined up, but I didn't have everything exactly lined up the way it's supposed to go. So it's a lot easier for you to, fulfill this command if you've got a wife. I think all the men would agree with that. Is that true? All the men would agree with that? It's easier to fulfill the qualification of hospitality if you've got a wife. Wives are just better at that kind of thing, and Becca is very good at it, so we look forward to having you all over. Okay, an elder often counsels women. And isn't that a whole lot easier? I remember when my dad was an elder, he would very often call on my mom and say, I need to go visit Sister so-and-so, come on. And mom would go for a number of reasons. That protects the elder against charges of impropriety. And also, women certainly are, in many cases, much better at counseling women than men are. And so there are many cases where you might have an elder who says, why don't you talk to my wife about that? And he's overseeing the situation, but he appoints his wife as somebody who can help with that. So he delegates some of the conversations with women who are struggling with issues that are particularly pertinent to where it's easier for women to talk to them about it. Well, elder's wife is very helpful on that score. What about how wives encourage and balance their husbands? I suppose every elder, every faithful elder would tell you that his wife has really helped him in his work as an elder in many ways, ways that I wouldn't understand. But encouragement and also balance. I believe one of the reasons God made it so that an elder has to be the husband of a wife is so that she could help balance his thinking about some things. If she's a faithful Christian wife, then she's going to be able to do that. Comments or questions about that? Now, what about an elder or whose wife dies? What should he do? In my view, he should resign. Because if you examine his situation and you ask, is he the husband of one wife? He is not. In the same sense that Romans chapter 7 and verse 2 says that a wife, as long as her husband lives, is bound to the law to her husband, bound by the law to her husband. But if her husband has died, she is no longer bound by the law to her husband. So the marriage ends when somebody dies. They are no longer married. So he's not the husband of one wife. What about a remarried elder? Sometimes people have questions about this. Could you have an elder whose wife has either died or has left him and committed fornication and he divorced her for that reason, that scriptural reason, and he's remarried? Could he be an elder? And he could be, under the right circumstances. A scripturally remarried man may serve, provided his remarriage does not cause him to lack other qualifications. Sometimes situations involving divorce are so messy that it would just not be prudent for him to be appointed an elder, because there may be a lot of people who can't get it out of their minds for whatever reason that they seem to have in their minds that he has a lot of blame about that. And so, although he may be technically qualified, it's going to be hard for him to lead. And if a congregation, for whatever reason, just will not follow this guy, then it would be unwise to appoint him an elder. Is he still well thought of among non-members? Could be that something in a divorce happened so that, and you can imagine scenarios, I don't guess I have to draw them up in your mind, but you can imagine scenarios where he just wouldn't be well thought of among non-members because of what happened. So, there might be those looming questions that would make it unwise to appoint him at that stage. Okay, we've got 3 or 4 minutes left. What questions or comments would you have about any of that? Yes, sir. That's right.